Greetings, fellow humans, and welcome to another episode of Off Grid with me, Dave.
And me, Void.
It's the Not Really About Crosswords podcast. As always, before the recording, we snuck up on a cryptic crossword and gave it a good hard solving, as a consequence of which we've each come away with a clue we thought was good to talk about, and an answer we thought was good to talk about.
This time around, that crossword was Buccaneers Puzzle, number 17362 in the Financial Times from Monday the 20th of March 2023. Spoilers ahoy, so go and solve it first if you want to avoid them.
In the meantime, of course, solving crosswords and doing quizzy things and all the sort of stuff that happens on this show does really call for general knowledge, so I'd better call for general knowledge. Are you there?
I'm very happy to be here.
Marvellous. Glad to hear you back.
Right. Listeners, we will now read out our three favourite clues from the puzzle. If you don't want to solve them, fine. Turn your ears away for 30 seconds or so. We will explain them later. General, can you read out your favourite clue for us, please?
My favourite clue is 10 down. The numbering is 6-7. And the clue is extra portion of bread is mentioned after cool wine.
And Dave?
I chose one down, which says, travelling, comma, get tube, dash, a pain, question mark. And that's eight letters. Lots of punctuation in that, sorry. Void, I think for the second time in three episodes, you've picked a clue with whiskey in it. Do you have a sponsorship deal?
No, not at all. Nine across was my favourite. Mature whiskey put away for party. Five letters. As I say, we shall come back to those and explain how they work for you later. But meanwhile, General, what else have you found in the puzzle that you thought was interesting enough to have a chat about?
The thing I found interesting was I was sent off on a little reverie after reading just the surface reading of Four Across, and the clue is kills time, a long time, where actors may be. The answer happens to be off stage, because actors can be off stage, and kills you can change to offs, time can be T, and a long time is an H. I was glad that Buccaneer kept the A before a long time. I think it's got a nice rhythm. But it made me think about actors being off stage and how valuable they find cryptic crosswords, or a lot of them do. It made me think about Prunella Scales and Timothy West.
Oh, yes.
Who are acting royalty, but who met over what they described as a polo mince and crossword flirtation. so they spied each other solving backstage. It made me think about John Gielgud, who wrote a letter of fulsome thanks to the Times for keeping him sane by giving him something to do in a job that requires a hell of a lot of waiting around time. And it also made me think about how I presume the letter was sincere, and that by the time he wrote it, which maybe was the 80s or 90s, he was an accomplished solver. But another actor told a tale of watching Gielgud literally writing like Mark Goodliff, the Times championship champion, who writes answers in as quickly as just writing a shopping list. And he said, "Well, doing great, going so fast there, John. Can I ask you a question? The entry you've put in there, what is Diddy Bums?" And Gielgud has said, "I've no idea, but it does fit awfully well."
Yeah.
But it's not just them, of course. It's, you know, sports people, I think, tend to like a puzzle during their waiting around time, or some of them do. I don't know if either of you have watched that lovely film Wordplay, the American documentary about people who are obsessed with the New York Times puzzle and who go to championships.
I haven't seen that.
No, nor have I.
It's a nice, yeah, it's good. It's got Bill Clinton's in it and John Stewart and people. But we also see one of the, is it the Mets? It's either the Mets or the Yankees, who says that off season he will solve by himself, but he really looks forward to his sport being in season, because crosswords are something that then happen in the locker room, and that whoever's writing down the answers never gets a chance to actually read any of the clues, because he's got however many people all gathered around him yelling out answers. And I just went off on a little reverie about the pleasure that these things bring to people who have to sit around.
group solving is just a great way to get into cryptic crosswords if you're sort of interested but you don't really know what's what, but you want to have a go. And you know, you might think, oh, I might be able to get an anagram or two, but I don't really know how the rest of them work. Then yeah, join in with a friend or two and learn the ropes.
It's always the best way.
It's certainly better than there seems to be a sort of cultural assumption sometimes that it has to be one-on-one battle. There's the setter at one end and there's the commuter with a bowler hat on the train and no aids and no dictionaries on the other. And that absolutely is not, I think, the pleasure of the whole thing. That I always say that if you're learning how to do these things and getting used to all the silly conventions and things, that you should have either with you or on the other end of an exchange of text messages, someone that will just go, oh yeah, well that's an abbreviation for a sailor or whatever it is.
And a friend who already does them. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I do like the one-on-one battle, but I also like solving with friends. So it can be either. Yeah. I like them both. I was once on a film set waiting around and there was a crossword lying around, so I did pick it up, and if I remember rightly, I think I finished it. I'm not sure it was a cryptic, though. I couldn't quite remember an actor's surname, but luckily there was an actor on the film who had co-starred with him in another program that I could remember, so I got to ask.
I thought you were going to say, luckily he was in the seat next to me. I was able to say, Sir John.
What's your surname again?
Sir John Gurr. It's on the tip of my tongue. Just, dear boy.
Cool. Dave, do you want to run over your favourite clue again and explain it for us?
Okay. The one I picked, if you remember, was one down, which said, travelling, get tube, a pain? And that was eight letters. And that question mark at the end of it really kind of indicates that the setter is being a bit cheeky somehow. An experienced solver immediately clocks that get tube A is eight letters, the length of the answer we want, and that travelling is a plausible anagram indicator, so you're looking at those letters. And it therefore means the cheekiness is attached to the definition part, which must be pain. So pain, but not really pain. What's going on?
I have no idea.
Yes. If instead we pronounce it pain, then that is French for bread, and French bread gives us baguette.
Ooh la 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 la.
One of several nice down clues. Yeah.
So a very nice clue, / very annoying because I didn't get it for ages.
What did catch your eye?
So, before I say which word I've picked out of the puzzle, a quick juggling tale for you. I was doing some walkabout juggling performances on a high street somewhere, don't remember where. I was juggling away, and a small boy, maybe 5 or 6 years old, approaches with his dad. "Look, Dad, a juggler," he says. And Dad then immediately comes back with, "No, son, jugglers are people who import jugs of wine without paying the tax on them. This guy is a smuggler. That's someone who stands there looking really smug while they do their tricks." And I thought this was hilarious because, you know, he didn't look me in the eye. He didn't break his stride. Just straight out, straight there. It must have been one of his off-pat jokes.
Yeah. It can't have been the first time, right? He said this.
Well, Pat said it and he got it off Pat, yeah.
Yeah, he reminded me of the dad telling tall stories to his son in the Calvin and Hobbes cartoons. Because he's often winding Calvin up in those.
Did the son have a look on his face that indicated that he understood that this was more of his father's nonsense? Or did he look like he was believing this misinformation?
Well, he was looking at me juggling, and I could tell that he was sort of listening to his dad at the same time. And at the same time, they were walking past, so the kid was turning his head to try and keep looking at me as he went. So it was sort of a bit, I could kind of see the cogs whirring in the boy's brain. So I'm not sure he knew it was nonsense.
But he was also going on an emotional journey in the course of a few seconds from having enjoyed your juggling through learning that this earned him the disapprobation of his father.
Yeah. So anyway, I picked the word smuggler from the grid. And this made me think of the old stories of so-called wreckers, people who would stand on the clifftops of Cornwall, say, waving lanterns to try and lure ships onto the rocks so that they could wreck them and then plunder their cargo. And I remember when I first heard about this, I thought to myself, but surely sailors would sail away from lights ashore because they'd think them lighthouses or settlements. So that didn't quite make sense to me. Unless I then thought, well, maybe they're seeking their illicit landing coves and having someone guide them in. But in that case, then they're being betrayed by their contacts on shore. So that didn't seem to make sense to me either, because, you know, in coastal communities, there's going to be a lot of people who work at sea. You know, every family's going to have a family member out at sea. And if word gets around that you've lured John Trelawney's ship aground and drowned him, you know, at best you're going to be persona non grata in your community. So I thought I'd have a look into this, and I found some extract summaries online of a 2010 book by Dr. Catherine Pierce called Cornish Wrecking 1700 to 1860, which talks about these stories, and they date back to before the 18th century and what lies behind them. But now I want you to fast forward to February 2002, and you may remember the cargo ship Kodima running aground off the coast of Cornwall and spilling many thousands of timber planks into the sea.
Yes.
And word got around fast, and to quote a BBC News article at the time, scavengers swarmed over a Cornish beach to retrieve timber, risking death in the waves.
Not to mention all the woodpeckers.
Well, woodpeckers, yeah. I mean, it is said that there were a lot of home improvements in Cornwall thereabouts soon afterwards, and lots of houses gained some new decking or floorboards. So it seems it all came down to who you believe what about what rights people had to claim wrecked goods. And this book cites a Cornish prayer, which goes, "Oh, please, Lord, let us pray for all on the sea. But if there's got to be wrecks, please send them to we."
Quality doggerel there.
Yeah. I mean, it does suggest that no one wished anyone to come to harm. But, you know, there was a deep-rooted belief that people have the right to keep any goods they find washed ashore.
Well, better to have the stuff recycled than to have it go to Davy Jones's locker, I suppose.
Yeah, true. And there are also a story that there's a claim to goods from so-called dead wrecks. In other words, wrecks with no survivors, that you could keep that stuff. But that in turn led to stories that people would kill off survivors in order to claim the goods. And on top of that, there were old feudal laws that said the lord of the manor had rights to goods from wrecks. So all of these beliefs at some level held sway, sometimes simultaneously, whether or not they were in accordance with the law. But ultimately, I was pleased to be somewhat vindicated that there is no convincing evidence for the story of false lights drawing ships ashore, but plenty of instances of salvage or plunder or what have you, of lost goods. And in another fairly recent event, a container full of training shoes found its way ashore to the Scilly Isles in 1997.
Yes, I think I remember that one a little more than the planks one, actually.
Yeah. So I just want to say that this podcast offers no legal advice in such matters.
No, well, I would go further and say don't be a wrecker. But, and if I were a wrecker, which I wouldn't be, to get round this very real problem that you've spotted of what if it's a lighthouse? I suppose I would recommend tempting ships by getting a woman from the village to collect as much fish as she can and make a sort of dress out of that, and then go and sit on a rock somewhere out to sea in the hopes that the cargo ship would say, "Oh, a mermaid."
And surely she should be singing as well.
Yeah,
she should. Right.
Although the siren might scare them away. No, hang on. Oh, dear. Anyway, General, can you run us over your clue again, please, and tell us how it works?
The clue I particularly enjoyed is 6-7, a six-letter word and then a seven-letter word, and the clue goes, extra portion of bread is mentioned after cool wine. Now, the answer is income support, which you are not going to see at first, because just as the pain is actually bread, the bread is not actually bread, it's money. So it took me a while to see that. But what I was particularly impressed by, I suppose, here is cool gives you the in bit and wine gives you the port bit. But the middle bit is comes up, which is indicated in the clue with the words is mentioned. And that's the sort of thing that I can imagine trying to set a crossword clue for income support and just absolutely not seeing comes up there at all. Or
it's nice.
It's very nice. And it's the sort of thing that I might notice if I had tried to write a clue for income support, not come up with anything, had to leave it, come back another day, nothing. Every so often, I might have the lovely feeling of going, wait a minute, this comes up, and I could clue that in a more sort of colloquial way than comes up, as in he comes up the mountain.
And that comes up has got bits on either side of it that are just regular words as well.
Yes, it's such a good spot, and it's one of those moments where you go, well, hats off to you. This is why you're in this business and good at it.
Yes, very nice. Dave, what have you alighted on in the puzzle?
Well, 13 across was to be, or perhaps tobe if you leave the word space out. I've got a couple of different directions to go in from. First, have you ever really stopped to consider how massively irregular the verb to be actually is?
Mm.
I think it's got the most forms of any verb in English. You think?
I am, you are, he is.
Yeah.
It's all over the place.
Is, am, are, was, were, be, being, been. What? It turns out this is another one of those cases of Middle English smooshing together forms from, in this case, three entirely separate Old English verbs. There was beon, B-E-O-N, and esan, E-S-A-N, and wesan, W-E-S-A-N. And they were used in different regions, and there was also a sort of subtle difference in the type of being that they conveyed. So beon, which obviously gives us the infinitive and the present and past participle forms, be, being, been. That was more to do with sort of continued existence, permanent states.
Okay.
And then ezan and wezan, which give us am and is and are, and was and were, respectively. They were more to do with temporary states. So it's the same sort of process that smooshed together the past tense from the verb to wend onto the verb to go. Think about it, you'll never look at the word went the same way again. Anyway, that's the first bit. But secondly, to be, I think, is also the start of one of the most famous quotes in the English language. I refer, of course, to be in England in the summertime with my love close to the edge.
To the edge.
From Close to the Edit by the Art of Noise. No?
Yes.
No? Yes?
Yeah.
I was thinking perhaps people might have been expecting me to go somewhere else, but so I thought if I kind of link that into where people might have expected it to go. One of Art of Noise's other best-known songs was Paranoimia, which featured the character Max Headroom. And Max Everon was played by the Canadian actor Matt Frewer. Matt Frewer guested in an episode of Star Trek The Next Generation, which obviously put him on screen opposite Sir Patrick Stewart.
Okay.
Now, Patrick Stewart, when he first got the part of Captain Jean-Luc Picard, was described by the Los Angeles Times as an unknown British Shakespearean actor. An epithet which his co-stars thought amusing enough to cut out and stick on his door.
Well, he hadn't yet played Poop in the Emoji Movie.
No, indeed. That's somewhat later. Yeah. By the way, Patrick Stewart also had a role in the bonkers 1985 science fiction horror film Life Force, which was directed by Tobe Hooper. See, there's Tobe. Okay, all right. Anyway, although Stewart had been with the RSC since 1966, I don't think he ever got to play Hamlet. He played other characters in Hamlet. For example, he played Horatio opposite Ian Richardson's Hamlet in 1969, and later he got to play Claudius. But Ian Richardson, by the way, you might perhaps best remember him for playing the Machiavellian Francis Urquhart in the TV series House of Cards.
Well, yeah. You might think that.
We could possibly comment.
Yes. The American remake of House of Cards starred Kevin Spacey in the equivalent role between 2013 and 2017. In 2017, he was also playing J. Paul Getty in the Ridley Scott movie All the Money in the World, when those allegations of sexual harassment and assault and whatever against him came to light, whereupon Scott reshot the whole role using Christopher Plummer to take over the character. Christopher Plummer, who I think I mentioned a couple of episodes ago with reference to The Sound of Music, is another Canadian actor, and he also played in Star Trek. He was the Klingon Chang in the film Star Trek VI, The Undiscovered Country.
Yes.
I think you're way ahead of me. Plummer was also a Shakespearean actor. In his youth, he played Henry V at the Stratford Shakespeare Festival. That's Stratford on Terrio, not Stratford-on-Avon, by the way, where his understudy was another William S., a young fellow Canadian actor called William Shatner, who then went on to become Captain Kirk. And, of course, the subtitle of that film, The Undiscovered Country, is, of course, a Shakespearean allusion. It refers to death, the undiscovered country from whose bourn no traveller returns. Part of the famous soliloquy from Hamlet, which begins...
Tobe.
Absolutely. There we go. That was nice for a sort of round trip.
Yes. And we won't actually do any quoting from it, because I did that way back in episode 6, 7, 8, can't remember.
There was certainly a lot of kind of where all these famous phrases come from, wasn't there?
Yeah.
Yes.
Very nice. That was a very... elliptical wending. He went somewhere.
Yes, I was pleased to spot Tobe Hooper in the middle of that and to shoehorn him into it.
Yes. Texas Chainsaw Massacre, was that him?
That was him, yes, as was Poltergeist.
Right, yeah.
Cool. Now, what about your choice of clue? Give us how that worked.
Yes, I chose mature whiskey put away for party. 5 letters. I like this because it was very short and it fooled me for a little while because I was looking for words for mature. So I was thinking old, age, aged, something like that. Mm-hmm. And party in crossword clues is very often do. So I was wondering if do might be in there somewhere. But we had 4 party, and 4 will often be telling you that it's wordplay, for definition. So I did, in the end, decide that party must be the definition. And whiskey is W in the NATO phonetic alphabet. And put away means deleted, removed. So we need to remove a W from a word that meant mature. And eventually it worked out that it wasn't a word, it was 2 words. We were looking for grow up for mature, take the W out, and that leaves you group for party, as in a bunch of people, not a celebration. So, yes, well done, Buccaneer.
Very neat.
Short and sweet. You fooled me.
It was a verb all along.
Yes. Quiz.
Quiz, you say? Well, we have three questions, and I have decided to bring in a theme. And the theme is not just that all the words are in the grid or the clues. The theme is what the topic that over the past 3 years of living our lives as we have has become, I would say, the thing I think about all the time, and that is food. Because over the last 3 years, I found it was just planning a meal and having it in mind was just a small thing that we've been able to control and look forward to and pull off when everything else has been so mad. So as soon as I've finished lunch, I've started thinking about supper, and probably as a result of that, and as a result of there being food in the grid, we have three food-based questions. Okay. So the first one is is the quiz question of the type. You're not expected to know this. It will be interesting to hear your guesses getting closer to the answer. You might know it. You might know it. One across. Right at the start of the clue, we've got a lovely clue for bisque. Bisque, when it first came into the English language, was spelt in a much less French way, let's say, B-I-S-K. Mm-hmm. And when you, in them days, if you had yourself a lovely bisque, it didn't have lobster in it, what was the meat?
Ooh.
What was the meat in the original bisque?
Now, I wonder if we are going to be able to get there from the word itself. I mean, it's a bit like biscuit, which means twice cooked, but can't get to meat.
The word won't help.
The word won't help. Okay.
The word won't help.
I would assume still kind of something marine. Would it be fishy things?
No, and that is why I ask, because it's very much not lobster, both in terms of aspiration. Mm. Or habitat.
So chicken, then.
It is a bird. It's what I would say a lower end bird. This is probably a very posh bird that you pay a king's ransom for in Shoreditch nowadays. But for me, it's the rat of birds.
Pigeon.
Pigeon.
Oh.
Get yourself a lovely pigeon bisque. Get it down, yeah.
Well, no thanks.
That was our entree. Main course. I was looking at baguette, which shares its B with bisque in the grid, mm-hmm. as discussed earlier. And that made me think about how when baguette started invading, as they would think it, Italy from France, and Italian bakers became very cross about this, and they decided to counter the threat of baguette with their own ciabatta. The question is, and this is one of those, perhaps we should do this, that you both guess, and whoever's closer gets the glory. When was ciabatta invented?
Well, listener, how closely have you been paying attention to the off-grid blog? Because you will find the answer to this question in it. So I know the answer, if I remember it correctly. I can at least get very close to it because I tend to write the blog. So off you go, Dave.
I have no idea.
Oh, that's good for me. I was feeling bad about not having noticed it on the blog. But if Dave hasn't noticed it on the blog, then I'm in the clear.
No.
It is only as a footnote, you know, a minor aside. Well, while Dave's thinking, do we know what ciabatta means?
Yes, I think I do.
I think I do. Yeah. Is it an item of clothing?
Yes.
Yes, well, you know, it's that old thing of hollowing your bread out and sticking your foot in it.
Your bread shoe. Classic bread shoe.
Yeah. Ciabatta means slipper.
Slipper, yeah.
Which was the name of the chap who investigated the Great Train Robbery. Slipper of the Yard.
Of the Yard, yeah. Well, you imagine if he was telling me his senior ciabatta.
If I've got the right Right, Casey was on. Right, Dave, what's your guess?
Yeah. Well, whereas baguettes comes from baculum, which is a rod, which is just really boring. I'm going to assume relatively recent and say 19th century.
And Void, you have typed this number in recently. Did it stay in your head the year?
Well, I would say that Dave is right with 19, but not right with the century. I think it was 1982.
82?
On the money. Hey. 1982.
Gosh.
The Ciabatta is younger than
springtime.
Lots of people I know. Yeah. Question three. We had, whereabouts was this? Was towards the end. We had a clue for starch that was made with reference to King Edward. Maybe we could do another, pick a number which is closer. Which King Edward is honoured in the name of the King Edward potato?
Ooh.
Hmm. Well, I've got an answer that's sort of floating about in my mind, but I don't really know why. So, well, I'll say the 7th, but I'm not sure.
Dave?
Well, there's a lot before the 7th, isn't there? So, obviously there are. Yeah,
More than six of them.
Well, indeed, yes, because you've got the confessor and his kind of predecessors. Edward the Second?
I've had a sort of second-ish adjacent Edward in my mind for years, until I read recently that it was Edward the Seventh, because the potato was first put into greengrocers in 1902. So it was a bit like the Elizabeth line, I suppose. We need a name for this thing. Let's name it after the current monarch. Yeah.
Ah, well, how about that?
But I mentioned that just because I thought it would enable me to mention something that isn't in the grid, but that is a fact that amuses me. But I'll do it as a quiz question. Which variety of dessert pear was developed by Messrs. Rivers, whose nurseries in Sawbridgeworth, Hertfordshire, contributed much to the British fruit industry in the late 19th century and was introduced by them in 1894 at a horticultural conference of the time?
Did you just say the answer?
I think you did.
I have said the answer. Which, again, is, I would say, even less inspired than just choosing the name of a monarch for something of saying, this pear that we're launching at this conference, the conference pear?
I mean, you could have phrased that question as, how many varieties of pear can you name? And that would have been the first one. And I might have stopped there as well.
Well, I mean, I've got one that there is a Williams, isn't there?
I think there's a Williams. There's a one that's got an A at the beginning and an OU at the end, which is handy for grids. Anjou.
Yeah, there's the Bartlett and there's the Rocher. And
sometimes only a Bosque will do the job.
Okay, I am. You have outpaired me.
Very good.
Very nice. Cool. Thank you, General.
Okay, folks, it's time for us to exit stage left, hopefully unpursued by Ursines. If you go to offgrid.tlmb.net, you'll find the notes and links relating to this and past episodes, as well as links to probably the most recent online puzzles by both of us, and social media links whereby you can contact or follow us.
And you can find me on Twitter and Mastodon as @thevoidTLMB, and you can also find me on YouTube with that handle as well now. I've dug up an old account I have and repurposed it as an off-grid account. So you can find a little extra outtakes on that channel if you find it, follow it, subscribe, like, etc. General, do you have any recommendations for us this Sennight?
Well, I'm still thinking about all those wreckers and smugglers and sea coastal lore that we mentioned earlier, and that's put me in mind of an excellent book I read that's full of coastal tales called The Shipping Forecast Puzzle Book, that is somewhat cryptic and somewhat visual.
I have started making my way through that. I need to go back to it. Yes.
Marvellous.
And so should you, listener. Very good.
All right. Well, thanks for helping us out once again, General Knowledge.
Right, see you next time, folks. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Off Grid is a TLMB production. Thank you to Buccaneer and the FT for our crossword puzzle this time around, and to the Trudy for our theme tune. If you're one of the 30% or so of our listeners who listen to us via Apple Podcasts, it would be really nice if you could take a minute or so to leave us a review on there. It is really encouraging whenever we get a new one. If you're not, thanks for listening, and do feel free to talk about us, post about us with hashtag OffGridPod on any platform. That'd be cool. See you next time. Bye-bye.
Yes, what did you think of my voice this time? I've been trying a few different ones, and I think this is the one I'm settling with. I think it has a certain... So I'll certainly be using this voice next episode, put it that way.
Okay.